Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading this morning from Canto 1, Chapter 3, Text Number 14. Text number 13. This is in the list of incarnations, section of chapter 3. And this morning we'll hear about King Rishabhdev. I'll read the translation and purport. The eighth incarnation was King Rishabha, the son of King Nabhi and his wife Merudevi. In this incarnation, the Lord showed the path of perfection, which is followed by those who have fully controlled their senses and who are honored by all orders of life. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The society of human beings is naturally divided into eight by orders and statuses of life, four divisions of occupation, and four divisions of cultural advancement. The intellectual class, the administrative class, the productive class, and the laborer class are the four divisions of occupation. And student life, household life, retired life, and renounced life are the four statuses of cultural advancement toward the path of spiritual realization. Out of these, the renounced order of life, or the order of sannyas, is considered the highest of all, and a sannyasi is constitutionally the spiritual master for all the orders and divisions. In the sannyas order, there are also four stages of upliftment toward perfection. These stages are called Kuti Chakbahudak, Paribrajakacharya, and Paramahamsa. The Paramahamsa stage of life is the highest stage of perfection. This order of life is respected by all others. That's about one third of the purport, but there's a lot there. I'll just go back. Why this is being presented in the purport is because the verse is speaking of this incarnation of the Lord Rishabhdev as being honored by all orders of life. So Prabhupada delineates what are the orders of life and who is honored by all orders of life. The occupational divisions and the social divisions, or divisions for cultural advancement, social divisions, like what's our role in society. the four occupational divisions are listed, the four social divisions are listed, and amongst them the sannyas order is of the eight. The sannyas order is honored by the other seven. And a sannyasi, this is one who's actually qualified, not just wears a certain color cloth, but has qualification. A sannyasi is constitutionally the spiritual master for all the orders and divisions. Then he gives the four divisions of sannyas, at least, you know, the strict historical perspective. Someone who takes to the sannyas order in traditional Vedic life, they would at least begin with this first stage kutichak, then bahudak, kutichak, bahudak, paribrajakacharya. The kutichak person from whatever residence or village they would live, they would go live outside the village, live in a secluded place outside the village. And they could go into the village on a day for their sustenance, their maintenance, their nourishment for the life, could come into the village and perform madhukari, accepting little from different homes as the means of maintenance. And bahudak would not enter the village, but persons from the village could go to that sannyasi living outside the village in a secluded place and offer if they wanted to. Paribrajakacharya stage is where they would keep no fixed residence and simply travel, like permanently move about. And as they would move about, perform madhukari. And Paramahamsa stage is no fixed residence, no madhukari. And it would simply depend upon the personality of Godhead. And if someone offered something, then they might accept. And if no one offered anything, then they would fast. They were placing themselves and feeling themselves fully dependent upon the personality of Godhead. A very nice example of this is Madhavendra Puri. Madhavendra Puri was the spiritual master of Ishwara Puri, who was the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya. So Madhavendra Puri, he wasn't practicing. He was on the platform of Paramahamsa. And that meant he traveled continuously, and he was fixing his consciousness upon the personality of Godhead. He would visit various places of pilgrimage. And in the course of his moving about, if the narration in Chaitanya Charitamrita was, he was in Vrindavan, and several days had passed, and no one had approached him for anything, to give him anything to eat, so he had just been fasting. He wasn't whining and complaining and criticizing people, what's wrong with them, they don't have respect for sannyasis. He just was content in his relationship with Krishna, and he was sitting at the close of one day by Govardhan Hill at Govindakund, meditating on Krishna's pastimes that he had just passed through the places where they had been performed, and he was chanting the holy name very peacefully. When one small boy, village boy, approached him, said, "The ladies over there, they saw you sitting here. In our village, nobody goes hungry. So they sent me with some milk. Here's a pot of milk. Please take this milk and feel nourished." So in the course of the exchange between this small boy and Madhavendra Puri, The boy told him that it's milking time now, so I have to go milk the cows, and I'll come back later and receive this empty clay pot from you so I can return it to the ladies. And as night fell, as he was drinking the milk, he realized it wasn't just a small boy that came and brought milk, it was Krishna. Because Krishna has deep affection for his devotees. Even if it was done through the agency of someone else, for such a person of such a status, Krishna is the maintainer. And the Paramahamsa stage is one who knows that. We can understand that in principle, Krishna is our maintainer. The mood of surrender, or one of the items of surrender, is to recognize that Krishna is my maintainer. That Krishna is my maintainer doesn't mean I do nothing. I just hang out, sit here, and whatever happens, happens, and Krishna will maintain me. But Rishabdev, but one does one's prescribed duty. And of course, the prescribed duty is not my labor that's maintaining me. Krishna is maintaining me. The stage of Paramahamsa that Rishabdev had achieved, he was so absorbed in concentrated thought upon the personality of Godhead, he made no effort whatsoever to maintain himself. But in it was in no anxiety. Of course, he's an incarnation of the Lord. He doesn't need somebody to maintain him. But anyway, this is the Vedic standard, that the sannyas order, and particularly those who are the most elevated amongst the sannyas stage, the Paramahamsas, are respected by all the divisions of society. So that's what that elaboration is about. Then he describes Maharaj Rishabdev, the son of Nabhi and Meru Devi, was an incarnation of the Lord, and he instructed his sons to follow the path of perfection by tapasya, which sanctifies one's existence and enables one to attain the stage of spiritual happiness, which is eternal and ever increasing. He's giving a little bit of his history, and he's giving a little bit of his teachings, his life and his teachings. There's a whole chapter dedicated to the how it was that Rishabdev made his appearance. His father, Nabhi, was the son of another great king, Agnidra. Nabhi was the eldest son. Nabhi was notably extremely qualified, magnanimous, a good character, and so on. So his father trained him very carefully. And when Nabhi was of marriageable age, he married Meru Devi. So these names are important because they're, it's like Vasudeva and Devaki. They're personalities whose purity was such that the Lord appeared as their son. So Nabhi and Meru Devi, they wanted to have a son. They wanted to have a qualified son. So what do you do when you want to have a qualified son? But they did, and traditionally we hear this again and again, they underwent great austerities for a long, long time. And their focus was one thing. They wanted to have a qualified son. Specifically, they wanted to have a son as their son, the personality of Godhead. That's a very lofty aspiration. But it was very genuine, and over a long period of very severe austerities and penances, and involving the brahmanas, qualified brahmanas, to perform Vedic sacrifices, Lord Vishnu was so pleased that he personally came to the sacrificial arena. The forearm form of Vishnu descending on the back of Garuda. The brahmanas were astonished, and so was the Navi and Mera Devi. So the brahmanas offered their prayers, and Navi offered his prayers, and Mera Devi offered her prayers. And the Lord spoke and said, "He pleased me very much. I know your intention. You'd like to have me as your son, so I will become your son." And he became their son. As Rishabhdev. And as Rishabhdev, the name was given Rishabh or Rishabha, because Rishabha means the best or the supreme. God is the best. He's Rishabha. And he exhibited all the qualities of great personality, his learning, his character, his kindness to others, his magnanimity, his steadfastness with his word, everything is described in the Bhagavatam. He was superlative. He was Rishabha. One time in Nabhi's kingdom, there was a drought, a lack of rainfall for some period of time. And Rishabhdev, the son, this is, he's just, you know, a young man, but there was some discussion what to do about this lack of rain. And Rishabh said, "I will arrange for the rain." He didn't go to Indra and perform an Indra Yajna. He just made it rain profusely in the whole of the kingdom. So his father could then understand, this son of mine, he should rule, not me. And so he went to the forest to achieve spiritual perfection through his austerities and penances. He liked austerities and penances and worship of Vishnu. And he turned the kingdom over to his son. Well, at this point, the son wasn't married, and one has to have a queen if one is going to be king. So he formally, and in a formal manner, he went to an ashram of a guru, doesn't give the name, and enrolled in the school of the guru. Although he was an adult, he enrolled in Gurukula. Specifically means being trained by a qualified guru. And then he married. And he married Jayanti Rishabha and Jayanti. And in the course of time, they had 100 sons, all of whom became perfected souls. To have 100 sons itself is amazing, but 100 sons each became perfected souls, headed by Bharat Maharaj. I'm going to ask you to hold this for a moment. For the 100 sons, something that's important to understand about the 100 sons is, although their father was a Kshatriya by his position within society, 10 of his sons became Uttama Adhikari Brahmanas. 9 of his sons became like himself, beyond even the realm of Varnashram system. They became the Navayogendras. We find in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, where the Navayogendras are instructing King Nimi. These nine perfected souls were beyond the jurisdiction of Varna and Ashram, as was Rishabhdev. And then the other 80 sons became kings under the rule of Bharat Maharaj, who, as the eldest son, ruled the kingdom following Rishabhdev, his father. The teachings of Rishabhdev take up a whole chapter in the 5th canto of the Bhagavatam. And they're important for everyone. It's specifically describing instructions that he gave to his 100 sons how to utilize the human form of life to achieve perfection. It wasn't intended just for kings. Wasn't intended just for Kshatriyas and not for Brahmanas, or it's, in other words, it's for everyone. The instructions of, as Prabhupada is summarizing here, tapasya, a core dimension of Rishabhdev's teachings, is found in those first five verses of the first of the fifth canto. During Srila Prabhupada's time, when the Gurukul children when the Gurukul was first started in Vrindavan, they would recite, you know, very loudly in unison and eventually from memory a number of verses and a number of prayers, and one of these is verses are Rishabhdev's instructions to his son. They're that kind of like basic, fundamental, important. And what Prabhupada has done in the purport is summarize and paraphrase, so they're presented in a very simple way. For starters, Rishabhdev instructed to his sons that they should not waste this valuable human form of life in engaging in the same activities that animals engage in, sense gratification. One shouldn't waste one's... recognize the value of the human form of life and don't waste it. And so that the what not to do was spelled out. Engage in sense gratification, fulfilling the animal propensities of the body, but rather one should direct this human form of life towards divine austerity. Tapo divyam putrakayena sattvam shudhyat. So Prabhupada has made it very simple here, just tapasya. But the tapasya, it's just taking that instruction in a general way, doesn't just mean undergoing hardship, doing something severe, because that's what the tapasvis do. They go to extremes. There are picture books depicting what the tapasvis do. Looking through one of them once, when yogi with a big beard was all the way up in Gangotri, you know, everywhere in all sizes, ice, and so the water is ice cold, and there's the yogi with his top of his face above the surface of the water, and his beard floating on the water, and the rest of his body immersed in Gangotri water, completely frozen for, you know, for a long time. Or another picture was in the heat of the summer, building fire in all directions and sitting in the middle of the fire. And then another one was he had a huge cactus slab with, you know, thorns this big, and he was lying down in the cactus slab. Then another one was he buried himself in the sand, and all that you could see sticking above the surface of the sand was a little straw so he could breathe. So that's not what Rishabhdev was advocating. Not something, you know, artificially imposed, severe austerity. But the austerity of, from the negative side, withdrawing the senses from simply following animal propensities, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and life is made up of that. It's a misuse of the human form of life, because animals can do the same thing. And so our doing the same thing in a polished way is not what the standard of advancement is of the human form of life. The standard of advancement is voluntarily accepting a curbing of that tendency and redirecting one's attention to the Supreme. And what Prabhupada writes is, by so doing, it sanctifies one's existence. It's very similar to the discussion that was being covered in Bhagavad Gita yesterday. You know, the managing the smoke or managing the spark. Managing the smoke is, you know, you give the fire the right amount of oxygen. Like, you know, little flame there, and there's a lot of smoke. Just adjust the amount of oxygen to give spiritual interest the right amount of attention, and the smoke goes away. So what we want is the smoke goes away. So but more, we want the fire comes up, and then the smoke will go away. So it's the simultaneously directing attention to the Supreme and at the same time withdrawing attention from temporal matters simply dealing with bodily urges and attractions and repulsions. I like this, I don't like that, and life made up of chasing after I like this and I don't like that. So Rishabhdev's teaching is, don't waste this human form of life in that way. It's so valuable. But then awaken the natural spiritual happiness, which is eternal and ever increasing. So we find this with his father, Navi, we find this with Rishabh, we find this with his sons. They had different occupations. But the instruction was universal instruction. Diminish this one, increase that one. And Rishabhdev, after providing these nice instructions, he is the personality of Godhead, so he doesn't have to do anything. But for setting example, he turned the kingdom over to Bharat, and he instructed his brothers, you help him, follow his leadership, and help him rule the world. And then he lived in the palace for some time, Rishabhdev, preparing himself for forest life. And then he went into forest life. And there's amazing description, nice, just not lengthy, but nice description of how he lived. He began becoming less and less and less involved with affairs of state, and even, you know, the consideration of having a material body And then one day he just left the palace and was traveling in all different circumstances of life. He was previously the king, but he was so absorbed in his ecstatic mood of devotion, he paid no attention to whether he ate or he didn't eat, to whether he was dressed or wasn't dressed. And he just went here and there in all different circumstances. And then another, some people, you know, they were, oh, this is our king, what's he doing? But he was not on the platform of king anymore. He was on, he's exhibiting a pastime of this avaduta stage of life. He doesn't give an explanation why he did this, but he at one stage laid down on the road like a python. So and just laid there. So that the description of like a python is that a python doesn't go hunting for food as much as when something comes before the python will then swallow that something. And that becomes his food, and then otherwise he doesn't eat. So that's what Rishabhdev did. He didn't eat unless something came before him. So, then he gave that up, and he was in South India, some mountain range in South India, and while he was there, there was a big forest fire. The place is Kutakachala, and there his body burned. Now, his body burned makes it sound like he had a material body that burned. Like, you know, for us, there's a soul that's within the body. And the body is animated because of the presence of the soul. And when the soul leaves, the body is, you know, one way to dispose of it is to burn the body. In this case, Rishabhdev is an incarnation of the Personality of Godhead. So our understanding should be his body is not material. And that he was performing an activity like his body was material. Something like how Krishna left this world. Krishna left this world when he was in the forest. A hunter thought that he was some animal and he shot an arrow and hit Krishna's heel. And Krishna left his body. First of all, who dies from being shot by an arrow in the heel of your foot? You know, it may be painful, but you don't die from that. And the second is that Krishna doesn't have a material body. Maybe that's first, and the other is who dies from a heel wound. But Krishna left a material body looking like his spiritual body, and here in this case, Rishabhdev, it's described right in the verse that his body burned. In this Kutakachala area. It's also mentioned, a very prominent part of those who know of Rishabhdev, there are the Jains, because it's said that the Jain religion is founded on Rishabhdev's teachings. There was a king contemporary with Rishabhdev, whose name was Arhat. And Arhat knew the glories of Rishabhdev and would regularly recite them and honor Rishabhdev. Prabhupada doesn't give details, but it says that he, in course of time, became deviated. And in his conceptions, although he retained a number of the essential things that are part of Rishabhdev's teaching, like tapasya and non-violence and so on. But deliberately undergoing austerities and penances in order to purify one's existence, free one's existence from worldly attraction and worldly involvement, sensual life, and becoming situated in spiritual understanding and transcendence. So Prabhupada writes, the human life is meant for attaining eternal and unlimited happiness by spiritual realization. That spiritual realization is obtained by tapasya, or undergoing voluntarily the path of penance and abstinence from material pleasure. Very similar to the section you're reading in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita. There's lust that's impelling the senses, and specifically the resting places of that lust, the mind, the intelligence, and the senses there, and pushing may be there from each of the different sectors. Therefore, Krishna's advice is to, through the means of regulation and transcendental knowledge, to help purify the intelligence, and so the intelligence can direct the mind and the senses away from that and towards this. So it's very similar as what's being described here by Rishabhdev. Coincidence. And a term that's used in the verse is dhira. Darshayan vartma dhiranam. Darshayan vartma dhiranam. Vartma means path, or the way. He showed the path of the way of dhira. Becoming dhira means to be undisturbed by material circumstances. Not like be oblivious of material circumstances, but be undisturbed by material circumstances. Now Rishabhdev gave that teaching. He, by example, showed he was so far beyond material circumstances he didn't even apparently acknowledge them. But certainly wasn't disturbed by them. And one who is dhira is, by strong spiritual absorption, the features of duality don't move you. This way, that way. This way, that way. By strong spiritual absorption. So that's Rishabhdev's teachings. But there is significant emphasis on, you know, dismissing the involvement in duality, or the involvement in attraction for sense objects, and pursuing that as the means of happiness. That, what Prabhupada is writing in the purport, the human form of life is never meant for such cheap happiness. I was having some discussion some point recently. Is there happiness in sense gratification? And then, you know, compare the happiness of sense gratification to the happiness of spiritual life. So, one way of looking at it is, there is substance and there is illusion. And in illusion, is there happiness? The answer is, it's insubstantial. There's no, like seeing the reflection of an apple. Here's a mirror, and here's an apple, and there's the reflection of an apple. Is there any nourishment available from that reflection of the apple? It's just a reflection. There's no substance. It looks like, it gives the impression of being what it's not. That there's no substance. So, in that sense, there's no happiness absolutely no happiness and sense gratification. But there's something, because everyone's, all the conditioned souls in this creation are running after it, and they keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it, and there's something that's impelling them, and that something is an illusion. Like, is there water in a desert? What's the happiness found by the water in a mirage? Well, there is no water in the mirage. It looks like water. And the running after it is what makes people, wish to experience the water from a mirage. So one look at the idea of the happiness of sense gratification is it's illusion. It's something. And what's that something? It's illusion. It isn't what it appears to be. Then another is to describe it as so insignificant. Or here, as Prabhupada is doing, it's cheap happiness. But, it's not too much different than saying it's cheap happiness or there isn't really happiness. Because real happiness is without limit. That's what real happiness is, unending. That's what real happiness is. It's like, giving somebody or selling somebody a piece of broken glass when you're telling them, here's a diamond. They're getting something, but it's not a diamond. It looks like, but it's not. Or it may look like, but it's not. So there's happiness in having the piece of broken glass or plastic, but it's not what a diamond is. The real thing is not there, but something is there. An imitation of the real thing, that's what it is. That's the happiness. So dira means to be undisturbed when such offerings of sense gratification come your way. Or if the mind begins to contemplate. One of the things that Prabhupada would speak about in context like what we're discussing now is Jamunacharya's verse. Jamunacharya, before he became Jamunacharya, he was a king. And he was a king from the time he was a small boy, because he was so brilliant that there was this, rather than retelling the whole thing, the king made a bet with his wife. The wife said, if this boy does not defeat your court pundit and loses, then I promise you, I will never disagree with you about anything. I'll always be perfectly submissive. And the king said, oh, you make that wager? If he defeats my court pundit, I'll give him half my kingdom. Mm-hmm. He defeated the court pundit. So Jamunacharya became a king. And the grandfather of Jamunacharya took a promise from one of his disciples that he would try to relieve Jamunacharya from that trap of being king. Anyway, so when he became Jamunacharya, he then wrote, whenever I think, having now experienced this nava-nava rasa, this ever-fresh happiness of spiritual life, when in my mind even the thought of sex life comes into my mind, my mind at once just spits on the thought. So that, that a detachment from worldliness, that's radical. But Prabhupada quoted it. What to speak of in engaging in even the thought of that kind of worldly happiness becomes so unattractive when one's mind has experienced or when one's being has experienced the unlimited nature of spiritual happiness. Which also says something. That means even if one is in a very elevated state, like Jivanacharya was in such an elevated state. I had this debate with one, a god brother once, Bhakta Rupa. I was saying, Jivanacharya doesn't experience that. He's speaking that way to teach us how we should see. But, you know, one who's on that platform, such thoughts don't arise. And he was disagreeing. He said, no, the thoughts arise. But this is how one deals with those thoughts, or this is how the mind just at once rejects those thoughts. Anyway. Dhira means remaining undisturbed because of a sense of fullness, of spiritual happiness. And that's the Paramahamsa state. Here's how Prabhupada ends the purport. Only these dhiras can accept the order of sannyas, and they can gradually rise to the stage of Paramahamsa, which is adored by all members of society. King Rishabhdev propagated this mission, and at his last stage, he became completely aloof from the bodily needs, which is a rare stage, not to be imitated by foolish men, but to be worshipped by all. So, Rishabhdev was on that stage, on that platform. And his life ended in a forest fire. And that's that place is there in South India. One can visit the place where Rishabhdev left this world. Okay. Anything? Any comments or questions? Yeah.
Maharaj, in the beginning section when you were describing the pastime of Madhuri and Rupuri, you were explaining how Krishna personally maintains his devotees. And for devotees at a certain level, he personally does, and for others, through his agents. So my question is, when Krishna provides for us through his agents, how to properly maintain the understanding that Krishna is providing for us and yet properly honor the agents through whom we are receiving the mercy of Krishna?
I mean, your question is a how-to, but the how-to is by Krishna consciousness. You know, it's a fact. So how do we take facts and, you know, make them part of our experience? It's by Krishna consciousness. It's not a mental adjustment. It's consciousness. And by Krishna consciousness, such realization is there. You could say it the other way around. The other way around is, according to Padma Purana, there are six symptoms of surrender. One of those six symptoms of surrender is to recognize Krishna as my maintainer. So that means I'm not my maintainer. It's not because I go and do my job every day in the office. I'm maintaining myself and my family. That's, you know, where the shortcoming of that idea is. Where do we get our ability from? Where do we get our intelligence from? Where do we get the materials from? Where does everything come from? If I don't recognize where everything comes from, then I have a material conception of life. Then the flip side of that is, Krishna doesn't have to come running after me. You know, like, you know, a small child and their parents are running after them because they might hurt themselves, they need something. Krishna does through his agencies. The understanding of Krishna is he does everything through agencies. Even when he may not, like with Madhavendra Puri, personally come and bring, Krishna is making arrangements for all living entities, or to speak of as dependent devotees. Classic example Prabhupada would give is, in the room there may be so many ants. Of course, these are newly constructed houses, so there's probably not some ants. But in India, almost in every household, there's some ants. They, where they came from, but they're there. And who is maintaining them? They don't go to the office. They don't go to school, get a job, file for unemployment. And they're being maintained by Krishna. And the elephant in the jungle is 40 kilos a day, and Krishna is maintaining him. So we're going to the office, and we have a paycheck, and we're different than the elephant and the ants. We're maintaining ourselves. That's illusion. We're also being maintained. But then there are agents that through which Krishna is acting. And part of understanding that Krishna is maintaining me is recognizing that Krishna has his agents. But one should not make the mistake and think, Indra is maintaining me. Or any other person. Those other persons are but agents. Some direct, some indirect, depending on the circumstance. Like the description that we heard yesterday of someone who I may have an issue with, but if I can see that standing behind them is Krishna, then it makes it much easier to reconcile whatever that difference might be. And to be able to see like that is part of Krishna consciousness, and to be unable to see like that is part of the struggle that we have. So Krishna means, just to summarize, Krishna means Krishna and his representatives, or Krishna and his agents. Krishna means all of that. Because Krishna works through others. If he wants, he can come himself too. Yes.
We want to have two questions. It may not be exactly related to the discussion that we had today. I was having a discussion with one of my colleagues at work. He mentioned some yoga that he's practicing. He just said, go to this website and check for him. I really didn't do it, but then I think ultimately it seems that particular yoga, the discussion I had with him is just based on self-realization. There is no picture of God in that self-realization. It's just that when you realize yourself, then you become all-powerful kind of philosophy. So I just wanted to, for my own knowledge on how to deal with this person, or how to kind of at least give him some tips on devotional service, I wanted to more clearly understand why is self-realization without God-realization incomplete? Because we have read in Bhagavad Gita that self-realization and God-realization are simultaneous. But he was kind of propagating that it's just self-realization is the only thing.
I got you. I've heard it before. It's like a child. It's a very, very, very immature conception of reality. to say, it's like a child saying, you know, what do you mean, parents? What parents? Well, you know, your house and, you know, your food and your those people over there and and all the things that are coming from them. Oh, what are you talking about? So it's very immature. How do you help a person that's immature become mature? You point out things that a mature person will see. Now, what about the sunlight? What about the air you breathe? What about the water you drink? What about the body that you have, that you're using for your process of self-realization? How do you digest your food? How? Excuse me, but you know, you're not independent. And you know what moves things from not self-realized to self-realized? Where does knowledge come from? Where does the effect, the effectiveness of it come from? What's regulating the movements of the planets and, you know, the day and night? And hello. So it's incomplete. There's something there. That something there should tell you there's a whole big something where that something comes from. If there's, you can point out in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is indicating kshetragya. There's two kshetragyas. You're one. And then there's another. And that other is not, you know, you don't have the capacity of that one. He's conscious of, he's self-realized, you know, he has fully realized all the entities and all their fields of activity. Simultaneously through all phases of time and space. This is a good beginning. You know, keep going. Consider. Chetragya chapi mam vidhi sarva chetreshu bharata. Meditate on that while you're doing your self-realization process and come back and we can tell you what, you know, let's have a discussion about it. If you could ask the person, here's like real simple, ask the person, do you accept Bhagavad Gita? If the answer is no, then, you know, what's the self-realization that doesn't accept Bhagavad Gita, which is the treatise that explains self-realization? And if the answer is yes, then it's slam dunk. With your notion of self-realization, let's take a look at this, let's take a look at that, let's take a look at this. So it's like, when you have an object and you want to understand the object better, you hold the object up to the light so you can see thing in full light. Let's hold this self-realization up to the light of Bhagavad Gita. What do you see? And you could put it as questions rather than telling. What do you see? You might get some movement if the person is willing to be thoughtful. in the light of Bhagavad Gita. Okay.
This is more personal. I have this challenge of judging people based on how to position myself during my work, thinking that, you know, okay, this person will do that way, so I need to get ready for this one. And then I think I get used to doing the same thing with my dealings with other devotees and other people in general. So how do I look out for that, Guru Maharaj? Is it necessary? You know, is it required to deal with people on a work basis or a material platform where we deal with different people? Whether we should be judging them or no.
When you say judging them, it carries certain connotations. Judging means like, you know, guilty or innocent or something like that, good or bad. But understanding your environment is not something that's a no-no for someone that's on a spiritual path. Having an understanding of the atmosphere in which you find yourself is natural. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, what do you do with that? What differentiates a spiritual position and otherwise? Best to see. Make efforts to see in terms of the Krishna's description in Bhagavad Gita. To see as Krishna sees. Krishna sees differences. So, it's okay to see differences because, you know, we're following Krishna's path and he sees differences. You can try to see the sameness, the spiritual spark that's within, and then there's differences. And then based upon those differences, you behave differently. Pandita Samadarshana Vidyavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hastani Shuni Chaiva Sopakicha Pandita Samadarshana. So while the pundit is Samadarshana, he may behave differently with the lion than he does with the Brahman. Behave differently with the Brahman than with the elephant.
Is the same applicable when dealing with devotees too?
Some similarity perhaps, but not the same. Because there should be some in recognizing here as a devotee that they have different rules governing them. Like the rules of the internal potency of Krishna. And Krishna is directly interacting and acting upon them, and their capacity to receive something more subtle or of a spiritual dimension. Whereas, you know, someone who's not like that can have no effect at all. Like, and another distinction is there that not only, as with the dog, the dog eater, the elephant, the brahmana, the learned sage, seeing them with equal vision because of the spirit soul, even more with the devotee is there's a spark of, or stronger than a spark, there's attraction for Krishna. And that's to be honored. regardless of whatever covering, may also be there. There's attraction for Krishna, and that's, in this world, that's very unique and special and wonderful.
This question comes from your Sunday feast class, where you were discussing about the elevation of consciousness, and in relation to Varnashrama, and then today's class, where we can see like the consciousness, if it is fixed, it doesn't matter. Like one can be detached at any point.
That's right.
And he can be Kshatriya, but he can be at the Brahman waveform performing the duties of Kshatriyas. So this aspires us very much to work on our, like, situating our consciousness. So what are your recommendations, like, you know, for the people like us to cultivate and be progressive in fixing consciousness?
Okay, this is like... The basics of Krishna consciousness. The first and foremost important is offenseless chanting. And then, you know, everything else that is supportive of offenseless chanting. The last purport of this third chapter, chapter 3, text 43, I think it is. No, 44. One should hear with rapt attention. One should hear Srimad Bhagavatam with rapt attention from the real person, and then he can at once realize the presence of Lord Krishna. So, hear and chant with rapt attention. The secret of knowing Bhagavatam is mentioned here. No one can give rapt attention who is not pure in mind. No one can be pure in mind who is not pure in action. No one can be pure in action who is not pure in eating, sleeping, fearing, and mating. But somehow or another, if someone hears with rapt attention from the right person, at the very beginning one could assuredly see Lord Krishna in person in the pages of Bhagavatam. So, by the process of Krishna consciousness is an answer to your question. And by the process of Krishna consciousness, that includes the purity of mind and purity from, as a result of purity of action, as a result of purity in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, the animal propensities being purified by proper regulation. Same as this chapter 3 discussion you're having. By regulation and by strengthening of the intelligence through bringing the intelligence to the pure words of Krishna in, as he speaks Bhagavad Gita. That's purifying one's intelligence. So the combination, regulating the senses, purifying the intelligence, then directing one's activities to Krishna on the strength of proper hearing and chanting. Yes?
As you mentioned, the real happiness is unending.
Yeah, that's a nice understanding, isn't it?
It's a nice understanding, but I'm trying to understand the happiness that I get while serving my parents or my husband or my child. Is that happiness real?
Depends on your Krishna consciousness. most likely it's a mix. So the intention is to bring our happiness to the transcendental platform, and then it's unending, unlimited happiness. So what happens when, for example, what happens when your parents have an illness? Or what happens when your parents will die? What happens to that happiness? It becomes sorrow, because they don't have that happiness anymore. They're gone. But spiritual happiness is unending and unlimited. So if one's happiness needs to come to that platform, and then when facility is there, we can serve this way. That facility is withdrawn, we can serve in another way. But the happiness is in serving per the arrangement that Krishna provides for us. So, best to take advantage of spiritual elevation, because that day will come when all those objects of service are going to disappear. So let it become elevated to the spiritual platform exclusively. Then it's not a mix anymore.
But how do we do that?
Ask him. He has the answer. By the process of Krishna consciousness. Just like, here's a practical example. We just observed Vyasa Puja, and we heard so many devotees that had some wonderful words to say about Srila Prabhupada. Think of Prabhupada's disciples, 1977, and here it's 2009. 32 years later, we're still serving. And we're receiving great happiness. So how is that possible? By Krishna consciousness. When worship is reposed in a proper way. On the spiritual platform, then it's increasing.
Guru Maharaj, one devotee shared a quote with me which inspired me very much. The devotee shared that, "I have found that the pursuit of truth is much more satisfying than the pursuit of happiness." Could you share or elaborate how the pursuit of happiness, or happiness is included, is inclusive in this pursuit of the absolute truth?
Well, say it the other way around, and that is, without truth with a capital T, the idea of happiness is on the material platform. And the absolute truth is Satchitananda. It has spiritual happiness. And then go the other way. Without directing our lives towards that which is eternal and full of knowledge and bliss, the happiness pales in significance. That's a short answer. You usually have a question. You have a question back there?
I just want to thank you for coming and giving us your association all these past days.
He's happy too. In a different way. Yeah.
In today's description and also in many other readings, I observe one thing. As a result of performing long-term or severe posturings, God comes in front of the devotee. While as a result of performing posturings, God comes and...
It's several things. It's not just the performance of austerities, it's for whom the austerities are performed. You know, materialists undergo great austerities. Look at the people who live in New York City and, you know, live that life. That's austere. And their God isn't coming in front of them. Or you go the extreme, people that live in remote place, in solitude, it's in the cold of the Arctic or something, or the deserts of somewhere. You know, that's austerity. So the special feature is the intent to satisfy the personality of Godhead at whatever the cost, no holds barred, no limits, to please the personality of Godhead. Like us. You know, our austerity, our tapa, same as Brahma, is chanting of mantra. Lord Brahma heard those syllables three times. You know this, tapa, tapa, tapa. When he was searching, he was born on the lotus flower. And he looked in all directions. Hmm. Where am I? Who am I? Where have I come from? What am I supposed to do? Just sit here on this lotus and hang out? Or what am I supposed to, what's my purpose of life? So with that inquisitive spirit, he deduced, hey, I'm sitting on this lotus flower, maybe if I find where the stem come from, so I'll find out where I came from. Then I can inquire. So he searched. He went climbing down that stem for a long period of time and he found no end to it. Hmm. But then he heard tapa, tapa, tapa three times. Because he's very intelligent, he can understand what that meant. I'm to undergo tapa. So he went back up to the lotus and began engaging in tapa. His tapa was chanting of mantra that he had received. So he did it. Ours is also chanting of mantra that we received. And how committed we are to the purpose of the mantra, not just do, but the purpose of the mantra, to awaken our dormant God consciousness. How much do we want that? That's the measure of our tapa. So, in any position, the fruit of our mantra chanting is our relationship with the Supreme. And whether he comes before us or doesn't come before us, that relationship is vibrant. You know, very prominent in our consciousness. That's the fruit of our tapa. Tapo divyam is not just tapa, but tapo divyam. To become situated in our original relationship, or our constitutional relationship with the Supreme. It's described in Sri Brahma Samhita that Brahma had two stages of realization. One was to realize his identity as a spiritual being distinct from matter. The second realization was what is his activity as that spiritual entity? What was his swarup, his spiritual form? And he realized that. And he engaged himself accordingly. And if one, so if one does not have proper spiritual guidance, and they read something like what we've been reading, then it's this self-realization without God. But it's, that's not what self-realization is, or it's an incomplete understanding of self-realization. I don't know so much about this, but I have a nephew, a relative that was, he's a Christian, and he was describing to me this thing, neo-modernism, which I hadn't heard that phrase before. It's like a college, you know, it's a phrase amongst intellectuals. And it's a phrase that says, all good things minus God. God should just disappear. Take a hike. There's diversity, not just to this religion versus that religion. There's diversity to God. And that's prominent amongst intellectuals.
It's the same thing that he was also
mentioning. Yeah.
I think it's something to do with Isha Foundation or something. Sadhguru or something.
Okay, well, some guru could teach you, you don't need God, you just need me, or something.
Basically, they don't have a thing of God. They say that they got to meditate on the vibration of the sound. Then when a stage comes, when you will be able to hear that sound so strongly that you realize the power within it. And,
that's very nice.
They do follow the Shivaga.
Different versions of the song. This is one where Shiva isn't there either. So it's just back to tapasya. Tapasya is not just tapasya for the sake of tapasya, or tapasya for the sake of purification. It's that purification means that the door is open, or you know, the there is openness to the purpose of the tapasya, to receive descending mercy from the Supreme Lord. That's Rishabhdev's teaching. Not just austerity for austerity's sake, or austerity for purification, but austerity for realizing one's relationship with the Supreme. Okay, thank you very much. Prabhupada Ki Jai.